Good morning. First case this morning is Good Pastor versus City of Indianapolis. Mr. Small?
May it please the court. My name is Mark Small. I represent bar owners and a customer of those owners. We seek reversal of the district court's denial of preliminary and permanent injunctive relief to enjoin enforcement of the 2012 amendment to the Indianapolis Marion County Municipal Code that prohibits smoking in my client's bars. This court has jurisdiction to hear this appeal under 28 United States Code 1291, for appeal of the district court, and also 28 U.S.C. 1367 for ancillary or pendant jurisdiction for the state claims. We would argue that the ordinance as passed by the City County Council in Indianapolis and Marion County fails even the rational basis test. May I briefly recite the facts?
You can if you like, but we've read the briefs, but it's up to you.
Well, Your Honor, in that case, I think the facts are fairly clear. Indianapolis and Marion County enacted an ordinance in 2005, set forth 13 subparagraphs about why secondhand smoke primarily is harmful. In 2012, the ordinance was expanded to include taverns that had not previously been covered by the ordinance. My client's taverns fall within the ambit of the expansion of the ordinance. My clients filed suit under 1983. They filed separately. They were unrepresented by counsel at that time. I entered an appearance. We moved for consolidation of the cases. We had an evidentiary hearing last October before the U.S. District Court. In preliminary hearing, the court had suggested we could establish our case for economic harm through fewer than all of our clients, given the complexities of discovery in the case and our clients' claims. The court issued its findings of fact and conclusions of law in March, and the findings were, with respect to causation, in several respects, were clearly erroneous.
Can you deal with the relative risk issue? Because, as I understand it, your position is that if the relative risk is not at least two, then the court shouldn't consider it.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But it can't even a number like 1.2, when you apply it to hundreds of thousands of people, if not millions of people, result in a significant impact on public health?
If one deals only with the numbers, but not with the concept of what we're dealing with in relative risk. Epidemiology doesn't actually dissect bodies. It's not a doctor going in looking at causation for somebody having affected something from the environment. It looks at numbers and tries to establish causation, and in doing so, epidemiology has standards that have to be established or proven. As the Fifth Circuit said in Merrill versus Dow Chemical, if 1.95 isn't hit as far as a relative risk, then causation hasn't been established because it's a metaphor. All that the epidemiology can do is look at the numbers out there and try and, by metaphor, say, well, we've established causation.
Well, of course, you didn't have any expert that could really shed a lot of light on things, because your expert was the emergency room doctor.
He wasn't just an emergency room doctor, Your Honor. He also was a public health officer for 12 years, I believe, in a city in Texas.
But he was not an expert in epidemiology, was he?
He was not declared an expert in epidemiology by the court, Your Honor, but as he testified, epidemiology is part and parcel with a medical education.
Right, but I'm just saying he wasn't qualified as an expert.
The court did
and
not qualify.
And that's really problematic when the plaintiff's witnesses were qualified as experts.
To some extent, Your Honor, but Judge Osteen's decision in 1998 in the Eastern District of North Carolina on the flu-cured tobacco case is one in which there's an analysis of epidemiological studies, particularly and specific to secondhand smoke. And Judge Osteen looked at the secondhand smoke studies in the same way that Dr. Dunn did. But importantly, in this hearing, I asked the city's experts if the things that Dr. Dunn were saying about epidemiology were accurate. If all those things that he was saying, it's the dose is important, the size of the sample is important, they agreed with all those points.
And now, then, you tendered Dr. Dunn as an expert, is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And but did you submit an expert report on him?
We didn't. We submitted, Your Honor, a statement that Dr. Dunn had issued to the Ohio General Assembly. And we argued before the trial court and in our brief that Federal Rule of Civil Procedure A2B requires that persons retained or specially employed to provide expert testimony must provide a report. And I think that in this court's decision in Musser versus Gentiva Health Services, this court looks at the commentary for that particular rule of civil procedure, and that rule of civil procedure had looked at an instance in which a treating physician in a case involving some type of medical problem could also testify as an expert. And the notion was that the person isn't really retained as an expert, but they might have expertise. Now, what we argued at the district court, for which this would be, there is no precedent for this, but the notion is still the same as goes back to Gideon versus Wainwright, where people can't afford to hire an expert, and Dr. Dunn flew up to Indianapolis on his own dime. He didn't charge our clients. Our clients couldn't have afforded to hire an expert. He testified. He gave cogent testimony as far as the science was concerned. When it came to some of his political views on other matters, that's irrelevant to what his testimony was on the science.
But tell me, is it your position that Rule 26A2 doesn't apply to Dr. Dunn because you didn't pay him?
I'm saying it does apply. 2B makes the application there that if the person is not employed or retained, and the definition of retained in Collier's dictionary is to employ someone through a retainer fee.
Well, you do understand that you can, in the law, retain or employ an expert without paying that expert. You do understand that, don't you?
Your Honor, not according to my understanding of the definitions of retain that I've seen. And Dr. Dunn, we made him known as an expert to the city of Indianapolis. We made him available for deposition by telephone. The city never took advantage of that opportunity to depose him. And so the city also did not object to Dr. Dunn's testimony at the hearing on the basis that the report that we submitted prior to the hearing was somehow defective. Now, the court took issue with that, and the court made the point that perhaps the city wasn't put on notice as to what Dr. Dunn was going to say. Dr. Dunn's statement to the Ohio legislature was rather clear on what he believed in terms of tobacco laws, and also what he believed about the methodology of the epidemiological studies.
Well, I would like to just move on a bit and ask you, please, what about the smoking ban prevents smokers from congregating at the bars? Because they can still come to the bars. The ban isn't on smokers, right? It's on smoking.
It's on
they can come to the bar, you know, and then go outside. And that seems to be pretty much a nail in the coffin, so to speak.
Well, except, Your Honor, that in this, our clients' customers have to go outside.
Right.
At their brief at page 43, they say at most smokers just have to step outside. When it's 102 degrees and 98% humidity in Indianapolis, those are rather unbearable environmental conditions.
And that may happen maybe, what, 10 times a year, maybe?
Depends upon the year. Of course, Dr. Dunn would disagree with the climate theorists, but it happened quite a bit last summer. And in terms of the winter, Indiana's winter, I used to live up here in Chicago, we have bad weather and sleet and cold. And at the same time as those people are being forced outside, others aren't. They're kind of selected out that they must step out outside to smoke. And people walking by the buildings all of a sudden are exposed to smoke suddenly when the people who would be inside the bars were inside before. There were signs on the bars that said, this is a smoking establishment. Those customers had a choice not to enter those premises if they chose to do so. And so the choice was within the ambit of what they could do, and they didn't have to. Now, as is the case in Wales and Scotland and Britain, people have to go by smokers every place because they're outside. There was no rational basis for doing that, forcing people to go outside. It was arbitrary or capricious as it was enacted by the city of Indianapolis.
And I'd like you to help me with this argument, because you argue both that the smoking ban has caused the bars to become insolvent and that market forces led to half of Indianapolis bars to voluntarily ban smoking. And it seems to me, and you can help me with this,
certainly,
it seems to me that that's an inconsistent position, because it would seem that it is possible to run a successful bar that bans smoking, and it looks as if from the evidence that some bars consider it economically superior to ban smoking.
Absolutely, Your Honor. But the point is that before June 1st of last year, there were options for people who wanted to smoke to go to smoking bars. So over half of the bars had decided to go non-smoking or smoke-free. I think something like 25% of the adult population smokes. So over half had chosen to go ban smoking completely. That was their choice. But then other bars, my client's bars, have a clientele that is not going to be transitory. They are neighborhood bars. They are blue-collar bars. As one of my clients said, they are hillbilly bars. 90 to 95% of the clientele of those bars smoke. And so that clientele that is there is suddenly gone. And they're not simply going outside. The testimony was they're stopping maybe for one drink on the way home, and then it's hot outside or it's too cold. They're simply going on home. So the market forces had worked, and had worked so that fewer than half of the bars in Indianapolis still allowed smoking. But the framers of the Constitution, I don't believe, especially when you read Calder versus Bull, written by Justice Samuel Chase, and in the brief it's Salmon Chase, that was a typo. Salmon Chase was Chief Justice in the 1860s. But in Calder versus Bull, Samuel Chase notes that there are certain things that government, federal or state, is not empowered to do. And amongst the evils that were a part of this nation's fabric at the time, slavery was argued at the Constitutional Convention, only referenced in passing in the document itself, but Franklin, Hamilton, and others argued passionately that it was an evil. There was no such mention of tobacco as being an evil or allowing people to do something on private business premises.
Of course, they didn't have the medical knowledge that we have today.
No, Your Honor, but Hamilton certainly had the knowledge of something as like alcohol as a vice. And I believe it's in Federalist Paper number 13, he said that if we tax alcohol, perhaps that will reduce the number of people drinking or limit the amount of alcohol being consumed. We've seen what happens in our Constitution if we don't follow the general trend towards more liberty and we take away liberty. And that was in the 18th Amendment. We had to enact the 21st Amendment to reverse that. So the framers were debating things about the Constitution at night in taverns, smoking tobacco and consuming mead or ale. I don't know what it was that they consumed back then. It was one of the two or both. But they, I don't believe, would have seen the document that they were creating would prohibit a private property owner from allowing conduct on premises that was somehow was wrong per se. I mean, conduct in which they were engaging at the time.
Could I take you somewhere else for a moment?
Certainly, Your Honor.
Before you before you get into your rebuttal time, where did you preserve your argument regarding a partial regulatory taking? Specifically, where in the record will we find this argument in the district court?
Your Honor, give me just a second. I believe that we argued that in our proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law, and I believe that's noted in the reply brief as to where that was preserved. I don't have the reply brief up.
Okay, don't worry.
Oh, well, wait a second. I do have the reply brief up here. I apologize. The takings argument was preserved. The city argues that the bar owners on appeal for the first time present a partial regulatory taking theory.
Right.
But the bar owners have been making a takings claim from the outset of the litigation, docket at 7, defended it in response to the city's motion to dismiss, docket 64, and included it in the bar owners' proposed findings of fact.
What page is that on, counsel?
That is on page 19 of the reply brief, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And I apologize for not being able to grab that brief right away.
Are you kidding? You did pretty well, it seems to me.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I wanted to talk about this specialty bar exception, because I'm having a hard time understanding your position that it wasn't rational for the city to treat differently bars that, by definition, have a business model involving the sale of tobacco.
Because at the time that this was enacted, Your Honor, the City-County Council was close in its vote. And as Councilor Mayfield testified at the hearing, she said, well, it came down to the mayor saying it's my way or the highway, allow cigar bars, or I'm going to veto the matter. As we argue in the reply brief, saying something like that that's not based on a scientific evaluation or anything but personal belief of what he wants it to be is arbitrary or capricious inherently. And so when he came down and said, well, it's my way or the highway, that amounts to an arbitrary or capricious action by the city. There's no difference between cigarettes and cigars. The Surgeon General's report says that. The city distinguishes between cigars and cigarettes for cigar bars. A person can't go into a cigar bar and smoke a cigarette. All of the in our city, and I called my wife as a rebuttal witness during the hearing, and she testified that when we were in Colorado and we were in Washington, D.C., I smoke a cigar. She went in with me and smoked a cigarette. There was no restriction against her, no signage. Nobody told her she couldn't do that. So there's no distinction. Now, the city's witnesses testified that there is some kind of a distinction. But like Dr. Hyland basically said, well, ultimately there might be some studies that tried to tease that out. But as an epidemiologist, he couldn't say that. And the city county councilor said, from the best of my knowledge, and I see I'm going into my rebuttal time, the city county councilor said she could only say from her own limited experience. May it please the court, we would ask that the injunctive relief be granted and the district court be reversed.
Mr. Will?
Excuse me. May it please the court, the district court did not err when it found the city's smoking ordinance did not violate any constitutional provisions. In fact, the court correctly found that the smoking ordinance actually reduced exposure to secondhand smoke and therefore was rationally related to the city's interests with regard to the general health and safety of the general public and its increased risk of lung cancer and heart disease. Simply put, the ordinance does not violate any of the myriad of constitutional provisions cited by the plaintiffs. It does not violate a fundamental right, does not restrict free association, does not enact the regulatory taking, nor does it violate equal protection. Most specifically, the bar owners cannot establish that the smoking ordinance lacks a rational basis. It is rationally related to at least three different legitimate governmental interests. It protects the health and safety of the general public of the city. It provides an enormous economic impact by cutting health care costs and making the city's tourist economy more competitive, and it satisfies the general public's concern for a general nuisance. For all these reasons, the court should affirm the district court's entry of judgment and permit the smoking ordinance to continue benefiting the population of the city and of Indianapolis as a whole.
Before you go any further, I want to go through something with you, please, because it seems to me, but I'm not a mathematician by any means, but it seems to me that there may be something amiss with the way your math at pages 23 and 55 of your brief work, because if it's correct, it would seem that almost the entire city of Indianapolis, or at least half of it, would be dead by now. So here it is. What I want you to go through with me is how your idea of a relative risk works, because relative risk is expressed as an increase in risk, right?
Yes, right. Correct.
So if the absolute risk is, for example, 10% that a non-smoker will get cancer, then a relative risk of 1.2 for secondhand smoke would raise the absolute risk to 12%, right? Because on page 55, what you seem to have done is just multiply 20% by the population of Indianapolis for your cancer numbers, and 30% to get the heart disease numbers. And that gives you 400,000 people out of the 800,000 total population becoming ill because of secondhand smoke.
Assuming no overlap.
So, well, yeah, some of them could have both. I can. Is that how the math is supposed to work?
I mean,
it just seems exceedingly unlikely.
That assumes that all 800,000 people have exposure to secondhand smoke in the workplace or in the home, as was teased out by the epidemiological studies. So, for example, with regard to lung cancer, there were a number of studies that examined exposure to secondhand smoke in the workplace, and they found an increased risk of 1.2 or 1.21. What it would mean is that if there were 100 people that were exposed to secondhand smoke in the workplace, 20 of those people would have, at some point in their life, incurred lung cancer. Now, we did pull those numbers large.
And 30 of them would have incurred
heart disease, yes.
Heart disease.
So
50 out of 100?
Well, no, again, that assumes overlap. I mean, you could have 30 out of 100, assuming some have coronary heart disease and lung cancer.
Well, even that seems like an amazingly high number, doesn't it?
Again, you're assuming that every single one of those persons had exposure to secondhand smoke.
No, you're the one that seems to be assuming.
We did. When we
I'm
pulled
not
those,
assuming it.
We pulled those numbers writ large to make the example clear, because that was the example that was given by Dr. Hyland. When you're talking about populations in the millions, as you do across the country, you are talking about increased incident that isn't 1, 2, 10, or 20 character examples of disease. Now, I think when you look at the numbers from Marion County, you find them in Dr. Zollinger's reports. The numbers are much smaller. I think there's a certain percentage of heart disease and a certain percentage of heart disease that are attributable to secondhand smoke. And he teased those numbers out in more definition and more specificity when he came up with his economic impact report. And admittedly, the numbers were much smaller. But that doesn't lessen the significance of the health impact. I mean, if we're talking 100,000 people exposed to secondhand smoke, we're still talking 20,000 people that may incur lung cancer. If the number is 30,000, we're still talking a significant, we're still talking thousands of people that incur lung cancer and coronary heart disease as a result of secondhand smoke. Moreover, with regard to lung cancer, One of the most significant points about that was that the numbers were consistent over time and have been consistent over 77 different studies. Always the approximate relative risk seems somewhere between 1.12, 1.14, and 1.3, teasing out around 1.2. Dr. Hyland said at this point no reasonable competent scientist could argue that secondhand smoke doesn't cause disease in people. And that it is a harmful substance. And it was based on these studies. Again, I believe 57 studies in the area of the workplace and the home show a high correlation between secondhand smoke and lung cancer. Similarly, with regard to heart disease, which is a little newer on the scene, there are less studies, but they are similarly consistent findings, especially amongst the large studies. The large studies seem to show much narrower correlation areas of concern and much more significant relative risks. And they all center around 1.3, which again shows the totality of the scientific findings here is really significant, which is one of the reasons why the court should question whether there should be a 2.0 relative risk gatekeeper analysis in this case. The plaintiffs have cited to that from the Federal Judicial Center. However, the relative risk of 2.0 isn't significant in the epidemiological community. And that's one of the reasons coming back to your initial question, that's one of the reasons we tease that number out to show and make an example that when you are talking large numbers of people that are exposed to secondhand smoke, you are talking higher numbers of disease.
You do have some exceptions which permit smoking in clubs and other things, do you know?
Yes, Judge.
How do you justify that, given the overall health aspect of it?
Well, the smoking ordinance hasn't been perfect. It has been one of those things where it has legislatively been difficult to achieve. And the plaintiff cited to some of it when he cited to some incendiary comments by a perhaps upset Democratic legislator. But the point of it is that the rationale, the exceptions are still rational. The city is step by step, incrementally, reducing the public's exposure to secondhand smoke. In 2005, it reduced exposure in restaurants, which quite commendably reduced exposure to children, which secondhand smoke has been known to cause increased risk of respiratory disease. In 2012, they expanded it to include bars. Now, the plaintiffs would have you believe that they simply did that. They simply just cut bars and allowed tobacco bars to continue, tobacco specialty bars to continue to operate.
And especially when council talks about the comments that were made when the legislation was being debated in terms of the reason for it.
Are you talking about the comment from the mayor?
Yes.
I think that wasn't during the debate. That was a conversation she had with the mayor directly. And I don't think that that's indicative of a lack of rational basis. Certainly, it's indicative that the mayor wanted the exceptions to stay in, and those exceptions are rational. Councillor Mansfield has been very adamant that she wanted a complete ban in 2005. She wasn't able to legislatively attain that. She wasn't able to legislatively attain that again in 2012. She was making that statement because she wanted a complete ban. And she disagreed with the mayor over it. Now, I know it's probably shocking to find that legislators and executives sometimes disagree, but I think that's the case here. That doesn't mean that the exceptions aren't rational. And we can talk about the particular exceptions. With regard to private clubs, I think that the city has established that private clubs can be treated as private entities and private residences. They have the ability going forward to choose whether or not to allow smoking. Some of them have, some of them haven't.
And that's dependent on the vote of their members.
Yes, and that was added in 2012 with the additional amendment, with the restriction. And it's important noting that is an increased restriction on the private clubs. In fact, the smoking ordinance itself eliminated some exceptions and restricted all of the remaining exceptions. Each and every one of the remaining exceptions was restricted as well. So the city's overall goal of reducing exposure to secondhand smoke in the public was accomplished because we reduced and we restricted each and every business. With regard to private clubs, they had to enact a vote. Moreover, there's a timing. So if the private club did not exist before January 1st, 2012, and they don't have that vote, then they can't allow smoking in the future. So if there's a new private club, they can't permit smoking. The same is true for the tobacco bars. Going forward, the tobacco bars will either stay the same or reduce as businesses close. Because, again, there's an added restriction. There's another restriction in that the gross receipts, the administrative line that was drawn by the legislature was increased from 10% to 20%, making the tobacco specialty bar hurdle even more significant. And so the same is true for all of the exceptions. For example, tobacco businesses that sell the products not as a bar but as a business have to have, I believe, 85% of their gross retail has to be cigar sales or tobacco sales. So these administrative lines that the city created have done a good job of reducing the public's exposure to secondhand smoke, and as a result, all of the exceptions are rationally related. Did that answer your question? With regard to...
If you were in Colorado, I assume it would also apply to marijuana then, right?
You know, it's not in the text of the ordinance. I thought about that question on the way up here, and I think that it actually probably would have to be amended if Indiana's regulatory scheme were changed, but there's been no movement on that horizon with regard to the state legalization.
Colorado is not Indiana.
Most assuredly. Now, with regard to the freedom of association, we think it's the court has rightly picked up on the fact that the smoking ordinance does nothing to regulate individual conduct. It does nothing to regulate the plaintiff's ability to access the bars. And so we think, and moreover, the city has established that the intimate human relationship here, or the type of relationship here, does not rise to the level of constitutional protection. The plaintiffs have established that they are businesses that identify themselves as Colts bars or Dart bars or neighborhood bars or however they chose to describe themselves. They know each other as friends and acquaintances. Some of them know each other's last name. Some of them don't. These aren't the type of constitutional protections the Supreme Court or this court have recognized in the past as being so central to the family, the creation and sustenance of the family, as to merit constitutional protection.
You didn't have an opportunity, of course, to respond to the reply brief. So now do you agree that the argument regarding a partial regulatory taking was preserved?
I don't believe so, no. The response that plaintiff cited to was, I believe, Docket 63, was a response to our motion to dismiss on the grounds of Williamson County. Our argument was that if they are arguing a regulatory taking, then what they need to do is establish that the regulatory taking, they need to seek recovery under the state's inverse condemnation action. That was what that was with regard to. They didn't specifically in their briefing with regard to the preliminary injunction or that preserve an argument as to a partial regulatory taking. We never saw that briefing or that argument until the plaintiffs submitted it in the findings of fact conclusions of law, which admittedly gave us absolutely no opportunity to rebut it before the court. So we would argue that they haven't preserved that argument. And even if they did, I don't think that the regulatory taking rises to the level that the plaintiffs think it does. Certainly the case law suggests that the general health and welfare of the public gives the city the ability to go in and regulate things, even if it means taking the plaintiff's entire business away from them. And furthermore, the evidence in this case is pretty clear that the plaintiff's businesses haven't been taken away from them. They aren't insolvent. They admitted as much on the record. The notion that they didn't understand the word, I think, is a bit confusing because we asked the question, and the only evidence that we've had is that there is a decrease of a few thousand dollars in the month of July of 2012. There's absolutely no evidence in the record that the business over the course of, say, November or December or January, when the plaintiffs would have seen the most cold temperatures, had a dip in business. We just don't have that record. Moreover, with regard to the waiver argument, I think it's important to note that the plaintiffs really drove this litigation very quickly. The push was on from the moment they filed the amended complaint to have a hearing immediately. The defendants did everything they could to oblige with that. We disclosed our experts, we presented evidence, and we we put our arguments on the table in the form of a motion to dismiss on Front Street at the very beginning of the litigation. And the plaintiffs never responded to those arguments. So with the motion for the preliminary injunction, they didn't address those arguments either. So when those arguments were consolidated into the plaintiff's response and reply, they didn't appear either. So the plaintiffs have really never responded to a lot of the city's arguments, at least until the first time at the findings of fact and conclusions of law level. I think that was fundamentally unfair because we put our arguments out at the beginning of the litigation. Finally, with regard to the Indiana constitutional arguments, we think those fall well within the waiver requirements as well. With the exception of the equal privileges analysis, which we think is well within the equal protection, the evidence here and the equal protection analysis here, while not identical, we think that the arguments are sound and that support a finding for the city of Indianapolis. Again, the smoking ordinance is an important public safety measure. It's an important measure for the city's economy. The balance of harms here is clear. The city is talking about millions of dollars in health and safety. The city is talking about lives that could be saved by this ordinance. And the plaintiffs have only brought evidence of a few thousand dollars of economic loss. For the foregoing reasons, the city respectfully requests that you uphold the smoking ordinance for what it is, a valid regulatory scheme enacted for a number of rational reasons, not the least of which includes the protection of the health and safety of the general public in Indianapolis. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Will. Small, how much time? You have 2 minutes, Mr. Small.
Thank you very much.
Baffetta and Enstrom conducted a study that was comprehensive over 30 years or more of married couples lived together and looked at the effects of smoking on non-smokers. That was a study that was disregarded by the epidemiologists here. That would have shown some kind of long-term effect. That's because an epidemiological study concludes that a relative risk is greater than 1.0. I mean, that's where you start from. And if it gets to 1.3, that doesn't prove anything. That's according to the Federal Judicial Center's evidence manual. Now, this court has held in another vein that it takes a long time, for example, to develop heart disease. In Rosen versus Saiba Geigy Corporation, it says removal of a nicotine patch for 3 days is not going to cause heart disease. It takes a lot longer than that. Secondhand smoke, as was pointed out in the evidentiary hearing, is something like 1/400th of the concentration of mainstream smoke. We didn't dispute that mainstream smoke causes harm. Finally, there have been a couple of bars that have gone out of business. Claude and Annie's went out of business. One of our clients testified that she was on the verge of bankruptcy. A few thousand dollars a month to these folks is a lot of money. And their people have left their businesses. They're drinking at home, presumably. They're not back there. Our clients aren't simply harmed. They're not big corporations. The big corporations like Nikki Blaine's downtown has an ad on Visit Indy's webpage. They pay maybe $30,000 a year to be advertised there. They're a cigar bar. Our clients are outside of the 1 square mile downtown that originally was in the plat of the city of Indianapolis. They're not there in that 1 square mile. They don't have the money for the expensive real estate. This is all about control. The city wants to try to eliminate smoking eventually. Laudable, but in the meantime, 20 to 25% of our people smoke something that goes back to the beginnings of this country's history, and they should have the liberty to be able to associate with one another in a bar that has very small square footage. Thank you. I would ask that the district court be reversed. Thank you very much.
Or Mr. Will. Or Mrs. Small, thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.